This is a podcast from ABC Overnights. Here's Trevor Chappell.
Now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York. And all the clouds that lowered upon our house in the deep bosom of the ocean buried. Now are our brows bound with victorious wreaths. Our bruised arms hung up for monuments. Our stern alarums changed to merry meetings. Our dreadful marches to delightful measures. Grim-visaged war has smoothed his wrinkled front. And now, instead of mounting barbed steeds to fight the souls of fearful adversaries, he capers nimbly in a lady's chamber to the lascivious pleasing of a lute.
They're all just little bits from Richard III. Gary O'Connor is the author of Sir Ian McKellen's biography. Joins us this morning. Hello, Gary.
Hello there, Trevor. It's just Trevor, isn't it?
Yeah. That's it. Hey, yeah. Gary, what drew him to Shakespeare? Because he's recognised as one of the great Shakespearean actors.
What drove him to Shakespeare? Oh, I should say his very, very English grammar school background. You know, doing school plays from a very, very early age, playing female roles as well as male roles. And then Henry V, he was a kind of leading actor at his school, Bolton School, where he played big roles, you know, for a 17, 18-year-old. And then when he went up to Cambridge, which was the place where people who were interested in theatre, he'd got a scholarship, an exhibition, and he, in order to get in, he delivered the great speech from Henry V, once more onto the beach, standing on the table in front of the tutor in the college. And he'd chosen this college because Sir Peter Hall, the great director of the National Theatre had been up there. So it was a kind of enormously accepted tradition of people who wanted to, had great ambition to become actors, to go to Cambridge at that particular time. And Ian fell in with that. And when he was up at Cambridge, he played part after part after part, including again in Shakespeare, and made such a name for himself with a very, very old man of just his shadow in Henry IV. And of course, this was a kind of precursor of his great role as Gandalf in Lord of the Rings, playing old men. I mean, he was an amazing old man at that age of 20, 21. And it sort of fruitfully matured all the way through, if you could say, an extraordinary way. But that extract you had of him as Richard doesn't really do justice to the extraordinary richness and colour of his voice, which, if you remember from the film, I couldn't find a bit to play. As Gandalf, there's this incredibly sort of fruity, rich, complex voice coming through, and this and the character that he fell into so perfectly doing.
It's an interesting role, isn't it? Because of all the contemporary films and contemporary books, well, it's not really contemporary, but it's quite Shakespearean in itself.
It certainly is very. It is Shakespearean, and of course, Tolkien was, you know, the who wrote Professor Tolkien, as the medieval professor at Oxford, who wrote it, was clearly in the English literature tradition of, you know, myths and medieval literature, and of course Shakespeare, although he himself personally was not a great fan of Shakespeare. But again, Gandalf is, and the words are very, you know, taken from the books. They're not made up by the director and his wife who wrote the script. So yes, it's very Shakespearean. You know, This is a thread that goes all the way through, because although he became a film actor very, very late in life, he's gone back to the theatre at the very, you know, on the threshold of 80, playing King Lear in the West End, and now he's in this magnificent one-man show he gives in London, which you must get him to come to Australia. It's called Tolkien, Shakespeare, and Myself, and it's wonderfully interactive with the audience, you know, and with repartee and him outlining also his very strong gay campaigning side, which is an important part of his life too, which my book also goes into in considerable detail. So there's this many-sidedness, complexity, and of course that is very Shakespearean.
Gary, as I was doing some reading about him, because what did he study at Cambridge? I can't find anything that says that he was trained in acting.
No. You see, there was no... At Cambridge, it was all amateur. There was no drama faculty at all. There was nobody who taught theatre in any way. There were two theatres. There was the Arts Theatre and the ABC Theatre. And there were several dons, a very famous one called George Davy Rylands, and John Barton, who was also a very successful theatre director in Peter Hall's Royal Shakespeare Company later on when he left Cambridge. And they sort of ran Cambridge Theatre, they mentored it. And because so many, like Peter Hall and Toby Robertson, directors, had been up to Cambridge and made professional theatre careers, it became the kind of mecca for people who wanted to either direct or act. So an enormous number of people at that particular, in that particular era when Ian was up at Cambridge, that's sort of 1968, 1961, they went into theatre or they went into satire like Peter Cook and David Frost. And it was a very rich kind of ground of nurture because everybody was so enthusiastic and they weren't paid and they all did it out of love. Yet people like Ian would be in 20 shows, you know, it almost became like a sort of repertory company, just going from one play to another. And if you were Ian or Derek Jacobi, who was the other sort of, perhaps we shouldn't say star, but certainly got a lot of the great roles at Cambridge, it was a kind of repertory with a formal, an almost formal system of hierarchy already, which was, of course, marvellous for developing actors. And they got a much better training, in my view, well, not perhaps a better training in terms of technique and background, but a much better training in terms of the experience of handling one big role after another. And as you say, you didn't know quite what Ian read. He read English, but like a lot of the others, he would just spend all his time in the ABC Theatre or the Arts Theatre.
So they really learnt to act from working with other actors and working with directors who directed them well.
That's right. And there's a kind of interaction between the professional theatre and Cambridge. And so the critics and people come up and the leading theatre critic of the time, Harold Hobson, said, oh, I'd rather go up to Cambridge and see all these aspiring young actors than I would see the Royal Shakespeare Company or some of the, you know, well-established companies, because they were so fresh, inspired, and spoke the verse, especially in Shakespeare, with such meaning and intelligence. So it was a kind of breakthrough, basically, I suppose you'd say. And that was obviously spearheaded by Peter Hall, who then ran the Royal Shakespeare Company in the early 1960s and built up this enormous repertory of Shakespeare through the Wars of the Roses and all the great Shakespeare plays. So it was a very, what's the word, expanding period for the English theatre. And of course it's expanded everywhere around the world. I mean, you know, it became the sort of driving force in lots of ways, you could say.
Gary, when you take a look at his life and he was acting from such a young age, was that from childhood? Was he in a household that promoted and encouraged that sort of thing?
Well, not really. His household was very nonconformist religious, and he went to, you know, non-conformist Christian schools. But his mother loved the theatre, and they went to the theatre. His father liked taking him to. His father was a civil engineer. He was very, obviously, very precise and organised man who had a sort of, had this, in a sense, gave Ian this background of being very, very, very well organised and in charge of his own life, which Ian has always been, which I think is another sort of fascinating trait in him, is his direction and his ability to, you know, forge his own way, as you might say, through all the kind of pitfalls and difficulties of theatres and companies and films and so on, and ultimately achieve his own ambition and his own sense of his destiny, if you like, as an actor. because this was always in his heart and soul, that he wanted to be a very great actor in the Laurence Olivier tradition. So it wasn't specifically in his background, although he did find that there was a kind of player in the BBC does this series, Who Do You Think You Are? I don't know whether you see it, have it over there in Australia, but anyway, they did it on him, and they did find that in that going back, there was a very distant relation who'd been in the theatre and in fact, strange enough, had delivered monologues. But there was also a kind of very public service tradition of activism and standing up for rights of workers and so on in the family psyche, as you may say, going way back. So he had these two strains from the beginning, and in a sense, he lived all the way through these two. So he was aware of this, of perhaps unconsciously at first, and then he found out, as people do, when he saw Who Do You Think You Are, with great surprise that his forebear had been an actor.
For a Shakespearean actor, he's not very snooty in that he loves acting, and he's done Coronation Street, he's done television, he did that terrific TV series that was there for a while called Vicious. He just loved to act.
Have you seen, you've presumably seen that, obviously, in Australia. Well, again, you see, this again is one of the fascinations of this complex, complicated man, is that he was always very attracted, even as a child, by the sort of, the travelling circuses and shows in the sort of setup in his towns in which he lived, and was drawn into the kind of rather wild, vagabondish kind of life that the people who in it led. So he was, and he was also very, very interested in musical variety, which was current in those days when you had stars performing and acts and singing and dancing and so on. And there was a singer called Joseph Locke, who was a famous Irish tenor, whom he used to kind of go around backstage, because his father knew the director of the local theatre, and used to watch. And he was obviously fascinated by this one man contact with the audience, and how this man kind of lived entirely, as you might say, his life through the theatre, which is what Ian came to do. You know, he never had anything else, and so he picked up a sort of different side, as you might say, much more vulgar, not vulgar in a bad sense, but vulgar in the sense of the crowd, of dealing with the crowd, sort of appeal and love, and always loved all sides of theatre and showing, you know, showmanship, as you might say.
Because he loves pantomime as well, and
he said
it's something that he would love to do more of, is things like pantomime.
Well, that's right. He was marvellous as Widow Tankey, and everybody endlessly in fits of laughter at the old Vic when he played Widow Tankey in Aladdin. And you know, he absolutely loves dressing up in anything. he just has to take over if he's in a crowd, or he comes into, I don't know how many television interviews you've seen of him over there, but when he comes onto the set and so on, and is interviewed, he immediately takes it over and starts, you know, delivering great jokes and teasing people and drawing everybody in. Not in a very aggressive way, but in a very sort of engaging and entertaining way. He's just absolutely brilliant entertainer. There's no doubt about it.
Does that mean that things like getting a knighthood, becoming a sir, was that important to him, or does he recognise what is behind that and recognising what he's achieved?
Well, yes, I think, he had a lot of qualms, as you can find out in the book, about whether he should accept it or not, especially as everybody knows, well known, that he was a gay rights campaigner as well. And quite a lot of people said he shouldn't have taken it. He should have kept his own stance of being outside and, you know, an activist and so on. But then he thought he could work better from within. So I think, as well, obviously, as it was recognition of his achievement as a classical actor and going on world tours for the British Council and so on, that he feels that it was also very important in terms of recognition of the fact that he'd been beginning through Stonewall, and as that movement went in the 1980s, late 1980s, and general acceptance grew in the developed societies towards being gay, that he was a sort of leading campaigner in that, so he stood up for that and gained a lot of kudos and if you like, sympathy by the way he handled all that, which is in the book too.
Gary, why did he come out later in life, given that after he did come out, he was so forward within that and a campaigner within that? Why did it take a little while for him to come out?
Well, I think because he was very worried that he would, as actors were, that he would forego the chance of playing characters, you know, who were not gay, who were of different sexual orientation, and therefore he would lose. There was a certain kind of inhibition, as you might say, or a certain taboo. And there was a strong taboo about coming out, much more in England than there was, I don't know about Australia, but certainly in America, which was all happened much earlier. You could say, in a way, his moment had come, and that was the moment, and that was why he got such publicity when he did come out on a BBC radio program and had an argument with somebody called Peregrine Worthorn over attitudes. So, I mean, you could say it was late, and he did say, you know, why did I waste so much time? On the other hand, there was the sense that he, I think everybody knew in the profession that he was gay and accepted him. And certainly this was true of Cambridge life very many, many years earlier when he was up at Cambridge, when there was no persecution, no inhibition, no kind of thing about that. But somehow his own reluctance to come out earlier was delayed for perhaps a variety of reasons, and even, you know, perhaps his own inner inhibitions about it too.
Did it affect his life and also his career when he did choose to come out?
Not at all, no. I think that, there was... he campaigned very successfully, and he went to see the Prime Minister, John Major, at the time, and tried to overturn this clause, stopping any sort of education about gays in schools. I think in a sense it became, his moment was right insofar as it then carried everything before it, and there was a lot of criticism at first, but in fact, it became a very tolerant society from that point on, really, and so he was, genuinely speaking, a leader of the movement, and he put so much sort of, what's the word, objectivity and good judgment into it. He didn't sort of become, he didn't go over the top, or he didn't, you know, he campaigned very warmly and successfully and in the right way.
And also very focused. I was also reading that there were other campaigns, other groups that wanted him to lead them as well, but he wanted to specifically focus on gay rights and on that issue because he felt that it would undermine the work that he was doing.
That's right. No, he was very, I mean, he was a very, was and remains, I'm sure, a very tactful and good politician. He knew how to, in a sense, get hold of the right people at the right time and how to work from within, if you like. So this was, again, you asked earlier about why he wanted to accept the knighthood, which in fact was given to him by Margaret Thatcher. It was almost the opposite in lots of ways. And certainly he was no admirer of hers, but he still had the kind of ability to sort of work within, and he thought he could do much better working within and changing people's attitudes gradually and without, you know, too much fuss, if you like, or going into being too violently demonstrative about it. So that was Ian's way. That is his character, undoubtedly.
It was really after that and later in his career that he started to get recognised more for film.
Well, that's right. This has always been it's something that he was unhappy about for a very long time because, you know, he was a well-known stage actor and then people would complain, oh, well, you know, he's not a big draw in the West End because he hasn't got a great film name, he hasn't won an Oscar, he hasn't... And he's been in big movies, hadn't been in big movies. So he did have to wait a very, very long time until first X-Men, the Magneto part he played in X-Men, first one directed by Bryan Singer, and then, of course, Lord of the Rings. So it started, if you like, very late in life, and he was always unhappy that more films hadn't come his way. On the other hand, you could say, well, you know, when the big film did come his way, it sort of made up for all the ones that he hadn't succeeded in landing before that time, because the Gandalf was such a prize and became universally known and a passport to everything, and obviously the kind of financial rewards that he hadn't ever experienced before.
We'll talk in a minute about how those roles came about with X-Men and also with Lord of the Rings. George joins us first. Hello, George.
Hello, Trevor. Hello, Gary. How are you?
Hello there, George.
It's interesting because first time I saw Sir Ian was in a great but very little seen movie, kind of a supernatural thriller set in the Second World War called The Keep, which I think must have been one of his earlier film roles, directed by Michael Mann, who was probably most famous for creating the Miami Vice franchise and directing Al Pacino and Robert De Niro in Heat and other things like that. So this movie was a little bit out of the left field for both of them in some ways, but he played a kind of a crippled scientist sort of trying to battle the evil forces in a movie where the Nazis weren't the most evil thing in it. I don't know if you know much about that, but I've had the pleasure of actually seeing him live on stage. He's come to Australia, which I think he likes quite a deal, a few times to perform in firstly in Strindberg's Dance of Death with Francis de La Tour, and then with Roger Rees, who was replacing Patrick Stewart from the original London production of Waiting for Godot, the famous Samuel Beckett piece, which is I've seen quite a few productions of that, probably the funniest production, probably the best production I've seen of it. Usually it's considered to be a very kind of serious, kind of surreal meditation, but they really turned it into a comic turn, shall we say, and really brought out elements of it that I thought hadn't been seen that often.
George, what was it about his performances, about him live on stage?
Well, it's funny because, Death of Death, he's playing a very kind of tortured character, but it's probably his restraint, funnily enough. And so it's a bit like, when Gandalf, he's kind of, in a way, he's fully restrained, and then he comes up with that famous, you shall not pass to the big beast, and it just thunderous power just comes from nowhere. And it's a little bit like that. And also with the Beckett, it's sort of like very meditative, kind of reflective acting, and just finding sort of the little human then. But you can see the emotion, sort of the darkness coming through underneath. And so with a lot of actors, it's the actors who know how to hold it back that sometimes draw you in and have that presence that gets you in. Rather more showy people. And he also, funnily enough, after the performance, he just as how accessible he is, he was carrying a bucket, as was Roger Rees, collecting funds for the Actors Benevolent Fund here in Australia, dressed in costume.
George, thank you.
You know the story about how he was sitting outside of the Estragon waiting for Godot outside the theatre in Melbourne on the ground, smoking a cigarette with his cap beside him, and somebody came by, thought he was a genuine tramp and put some money in the hat.
Was that one of the George, thank you. Is that one of the greatness, one of the things, and as George points out, the great actors know when to be restrained and then know when to put it out there. Is that one of the things that he does particularly well?
I think he does, yes. I think he's got a marvellous control and a sense of audience, and you've only got to be in the house and watch the way he can play an audience, how he, you know, if he was playing Macbeth, for instance, he was absolutely terrifying, so much so that, you know, priests would come every night and think there was so much sin and evil around in the character he was playing, they had to bless it or say some words to alleviate the darkness. But certainly he has... if you see him come on stage and see, well, you know, the way he fixes members of the audience, draws everybody in. He's a great drawer, puller in of everybody around him to what he's doing, of course, which is one of the greatest attributes an actor can have. But he wasn't always like that. He was very shy as an actor in Cambridge. He was very withdrawn. He was very complexed about the dark secret of being gay, and thought for the at that time he could only let himself go when he was in playing a role, and otherwise he would keep everything hidden and worry about the sort of guilt, because obviously his father, who died when he was very young, well, not that young, but when he'd started on his career, but his father never knew that he was gay, and he'd never told him. So there's a lot of complex sort of mystery and side in Ian's character as he develops through his life. But what is fascinating in life is that it's always developing. He's always moving on. He's always shaping things. He's always, you know, he was starting a role. He wasn't a very good Hamlet. He wasn't a very good Juliet, and got panned by the critics. But the way he keeps on at things, he in the end turns it around. When they go on tour, he learns, he develops, he shapes, he practices in a way that he overcomes his shortcomings and anything that may be standing in his way, you know, in terms of making this role into success.
Gary, you mentioned earlier about because he basically learnt acting by acting and through Cambridge and with other theatre companies that he was part of. Does he continue that now? Is it something that he likes to give back the same way that he was supported?
Well, he's not sort of formally... he's terribly encouraging to people who come and ask him things and so on, but I think he's still very much in full sight as an actor, and, you know, he's married to the theatre and the stage and performance, and so he's now nightly in a West End London show, a single show, you know, so many hours, and he's on stage all the time. So he's not someone, although he's been amazingly generous and in terms of supporting theatres, like the Park Theatre in London, for instance, and doing charity shows to raise funds for things. I wouldn't call him a teacher in the way that, you know, he's surrounded by a sort of group whom he monitors and develops and gives advice to. Well, that's my understanding anyway.
Has he got people that he likes to work with?
Yeah, I think he's very... very few people have fallen out with him in acting, but he has shown at times impatience because he likes to improvise, and everybody has different ways of acting. I mean, you know, he was, for instance, in Lord of the Rings, Ian Holm, and he approached the scenes that they played together in completely different ways. But he's very accommodating, although he has been known sometimes to be too much, perhaps, of a perfectionist, and he likes to, in a way, to be the controlling force. I mean, there's no doubt about that. I mean, they had this company called the Actors Company, and they all play different roles. But then they joked about the fact that when he played, say Hamlet, he was Hamlet, but when he played the footman in a play by a French farceur, he played the role so much that the play should have been called The Footman.
I just want to talk a little bit about his television. He did a terrific little role in Extras, where he plays a gay director. He played then, as I was spoken about earlier, Vicious, which was a lovely series about a gay couple.
That's right.
What did he like about television?
Well, I think he's... again, he's very, so very relaxed. He has no sort of fears or inhibitions in learning or in relaxing. I mean, I went along to some of the recordings for the show, and to see these two performers who'd been at Cambridge together, Derek Jacobi and Ian, both on set, you know, actually in the takes and in between when they sort of indulged in Nepati, which was very funny too. He just has a sort of gifted informality, as you might say, of relaxing everybody around him. And this, of course, is perfect for television because, you know, we were in an audience, a television audience, ambitious, and the audience was immediately on his side, even though there was a great battery of, you know, cameras and acoustic things and everything all in between the audience and the set. And somehow this, you almost get a sense that he doesn't really mind, you know. I mean, he's got this kind of, which I think is very interesting, and I try to go into in the book, this sort of philosophical basis of being so much in present and in what he's doing that it sort of completely relaxes everybody around him and takes everybody in and makes everybody feel happy and at ease. So this is kind of perfect for television, isn't it? So,
what? It interests me with people like him who has such a devotion to acting and to theatre. What, with whatever spare time that he had, what did he like to do?
Oh, good question. I think he's so completely and utterly taken up. You can't sort of identify hobbies. I mean, I think what you could say is it's friends. It's people, you know, he likes to see and talk and phone and be in touch with and so on and so forth. You can't say he's a gardener in his sort of East End flat on the Thames, sorry, not flat, house on the Thames, or he's interested in any specific hobbies that he's pursued all the way through. No, I mean, I think the theatre is just an all-consuming love. And in that love, he sees it as a huge family. So, you know, he's very related, he's very aware of people, birthdays, gifts, whatever, and so on. So keeping up with people who are not well and that kind of thing. And generally spreading a very good sort of aura of love and generosity around him.
Gary, has he had a very settled life in the theatre? Well, he'll be travelling, he'll be doing all sorts of things. Has he been very grounded as far as where he lives and also within relationships?
Well, he's not had permanent relationships, as you know from the book. He's had two sort of relationships that have lasted nearly 10 years, and neither of them became permanent. So he's very much, you know, as he says, well, I think it's one of those programs, Who Do You Think You Are? I'm a bit of an orphan, really. I'm on my own. And so he's not really settled down into, you know, a long-term marriage or whatever at all. So the theatre has consumed him, his muse, if you like, all the way through, and provided certainly an enormous amount of offstage friendships and connections and so on, which he pursues and keeps up with.
As he continues with his career, I mean, does it look like there are other things ahead of him, but does it look like he'll slow down or, heaven forbid, stop?
I don't think he probably will. I mean, in a sense, you can see the rise of his career insofar as he wanted to emulate the greatest actors of his time, especially Olivier. So he played King Lear twice towards the end of his life, first on the world tour when he came to Australia, didn't he? I think in the first King Lear he played. And then, or perhaps he didn't, and then this last year that he played before the one-man show, that was just a year ago, a couple of years ago, before his 80th birthday. So he's now 80 years old, in his 80th, late 81st year. And you don't see any signs. I mean, he's got several films on the go, which are going to come out later. it's hard to envisage him. I don't know whether he would take on another Shakespearean role, but it's hard to see him coming down from that pinnacle that he has reached with King Lear to play other old roles in Shakespeare. But there may be some part or stage part that somebody can propose for him that I'm sure he would do.
Gary, could you just very quickly, because we're a couple of minutes away from our news,
sure.
Tell us how Gandalf came about.
Well, it came about because it was turned down quite a bit by everybody, so it wasn't as if he'd was going to be there from the start, and so Sean Connery, for instance, was offered it first, and then it was Christopher Plummer and various others, and somehow they all said no for various reasons. I can't understand why. You know, Sean Connery was offered such an enormous amount of money. He said he couldn't understand the book, and Christopher Plummer said he didn't want to go to New Zealand for a year and a half, or Croak or something. It was only a joke when he was filming. So it fell to Ian, who was much less known than the others, to actually be finally cast. And it's extraordinary. You know, as he said, no one is ever first choice in the theatre, and yet the part so seems perfectly to fit in with him, and Peter Jackson, the director, obviously could see that straight away, and yet it wasn't a choice, and he wasn't the first choice, which is, when you consider it, just the lottery, in the sense that theatre is.
And as we hear and know about it now, you can't think of anyone else that would be able to do Gandalf.
Can you? And I think the interesting thing is that Tolkien, as I write up in the book, was very, you know, there was quite a lot of fascinating parallel between the lives of Tolkien, who obviously created the role of Gandalf from his own.
And that's true. I've got to go because the news is coming up. Thank you very much for joining us. This is Overnight.
Well, we could go.